Chapter 22. And continuing to peel his egg, the accumulating scarlet told that was her meaning, as much as the affirmative reply. I should have put up with it, no doubt, apostrophe Mr. Swancourt observed. So that he would not have been driven into hopeless melancholy, but have made the best of him? Apostrophe apostrophe, Elfright's erratic mind had from her youth upwards been constantly in the habit of perplexing her father by hypothetical questions, based on absurd conditions. The present seemed to be cast so precisely in the mold of previous ones that, not being given to syntheses of circumstances, he answered it with customary complacency. If he were lied to us irretrievably, of course I, or any sensible man, should accept conditions that could not be altered. Certainly not be hopelessly melancholy about it. I don't believe anything in the world would make me hopelessly melancholy. And don't let anything make you so either. Apostrophe apostrophe, I won't, Papa, apostrophe she cried, with a serene brightness that pleased him. Certainly Mr. Swancourt must have been far from thinking that the brightness came from an exhilarating intention to hold back no longer from the mad action as he had planned. In the evening he drove away towards Stradleigh, quite alone. It was an unusual course for him. At the door Elfright had been again almost impelled by her feelings to pour out all. Why are you going to Stradleigh, Papa? Apostrophe apostrophe she said, and looked at him longingly. I will tell you tomorrow when I come back, apostrophe he said cheerily. Not before then, Elfright. Thou wilt not utter what thou dost not know, and so far will I trust thee, gentle Elfright. Apostrophe apostrophe she was repressed and hurt. I will tell you my errand to Plymouth too, when I come back, apostrophe she murmured. He went away. His jocularity made her intention seem the lighter, as his indifference made her more resolved to do as she liked. It was a familiar September sunset, dark blue fragments of cloud upon an orange-yellow sky. These sunsets used to tempt her to walk towards them, as any beautiful thing tempts a near approach. She went through the field to the privet hedge, clambered into the middle of it, and reclined upon the thick boughs. After looking westward for a considerable time, she blamed herself for not looking eastward to where Stephen was, and turned round. Ultimately her eyes fell upon the ground. A peculiarity was observable beneath her. A green field spread itself on each side of the hedge, one belonging to the glebe, the other being a part of the land attached to the manor house adjoining. On the vicarage side she saw a little footpath, the distinctive and altogether exceptional feature, of which consisted in its being only about 10 yards long. It terminated abruptly at each end. A footpath, suddenly beginning and suddenly ending, coming from nowhere and leading nowhere, as he had never seen before. Yes, as he had, on second thoughts. As he had seen exactly such a path trodden in the front of barracks by the sentry. And this recollection explained the origin of the path here. Her father had trodden it, by pacing up and down, as he had once seen him doing. Sitting on the hedge as she sat now, her eyes commanded a view of both sides of it. And a few minutes later, Elfright looked over to the manor side. Here was another sentry path. It was like the first in length, and it began and ended exactly opposite the beginning and ending of its neighbor, but it was thinner and less distinct. Two reasons existed for the difference. This one might have been trodden by a similar weight of tread to the other, exercised a less number of times, or it might have been walked just as frequently, but by lighter feet. Probably a gentleman from Scotland Yard, had he been passing at the time, might have considered the latter alternative as the more probable. Elfright thought otherwise, so far as she thought at all. But her own great tomorrow was now imminent. All thoughts inspired by casual sights of the eye were only allowed to exercise themselves in inferior corners of her brain, previously to being banished altogether. Elfright was at length compelled to reason practically upon her undertaking. all her definite perceptions thereon, when the emotion accompanying them was abstracted, amounted to no more than these. Say an hour and three quarters, to ride to St. Launce's. Say half an hour at the Falcon to change my dress. Say 2 hours waiting for some train, and getting to Plymouth. Say an hour to spare before 12 o'clock. Total time from leaving in Delstow till 12 o'clock, 5 hours. Therefore I shall have to start at 7. Apostrophe apostrophe, no surprise or sense of unwontedness entered the minds of the servants at her early ride. The monotony of life we associate with people of small incomes in districts out of the sound of the railway whistle, has one exception, which puts into shade the experience of dwellers about the great centers of population, that is, in traveling. Every journey there is more or less an adventure. Adventurous hours are necessarily chosen for the most commonplace outing. Miss Elfright had to leave early, that was all. Elfright never went out on horseback, but she brought home something found, or something bought. If she trotted to town or village, her burden was books. If to hills, woods, or the seashore, it was wonderful mosses, abnormal twigs, a handkerchief of wet shells or seaweed. Once, in muddy weather, when Pansy was walking with her down the street of Castle Botterill, on a fair day, a packet in front of her, and a packet under her arm, an accident befell the packets, and they slipped down. On one side of her, three volumes of fiction lay kissing the mud. On the other, numerous skeins of polychromatic wools lay absorbing it. Unpleasant women smiled through windows at the mishap, the men all looked round, and a boy, who was minding a gingerbread stall, whilst the owner had gone to get drunk, laughed loudly. The blue eyes turned to sapphires, and the cheeks crimsoned with vexation. After that misadventure she set her wits to work, and was ingenious enough to invent an arrangement of small straps about the saddle, by which a great deal could be safely carried thereon, in a small compass. Here she now spread out, and fastened a plain dark walking dress, and a few other trifles of apparel. Worm opened the gate for her, and she vanished away. One of the brightest mornings of late summer shone upon her. The heather was at its purplest, the firs at its yellowest, the grasshoppers chirped loud enough for birds, the snakes hissed like little engines, and Elfright at first felt lively. Sitting at ease upon Pansy, in her orthodox riding habit and nondescript hat, she looked what she felt. But the mercury of those days had a trick of falling unexpectedly. First, only for 1 minute in 10 had she a sense of depression. Then a large cloud, that had been hanging in the north like a black fleece, came and placed itself between her and the sun. It helped on what was already inevitable, and she sank into a uniformity of sadness. She turned in the saddle and looked back. They were now on an open table land, whose altitude still gave her a view of the sea by Indelstow. She looked longingly at that spot. During this little revulsion of feeling, Pansy had been still advancing, and Elfright felt it would be absurd to turn her little mare's head the other way. Still, apostrophe she thought, if I had a mama at home I would go back. Apostrophe apostrophe, and making one of those stealthy movements by which women let their hearts juggle with their brains, she did put the horse's head about, as if unconsciously, and went at a hand gallop towards home for more than a mile. By this time, from the inveterate habit of valuing what we have renounced directly the alternative is chosen, the thought of her forsaken Stephen recalled her, and she turned about, and cantered on to St. Launce's again. This miserable strife of thought now began to rage in all its wildness. Overwrought and trembling, she dropped the rein upon Pansy's shoulders, and vowed she would be led, whither the horse would take her. Pansy slackened her pace to a walk, and walked on with her agitated burden for 3 or 4 minutes. At the expiration of this time they had come to a little byway on the right, leading down a slope to a pool of water. The pony stopped, looked towards the pool, and then advanced and stooped to drink. Elfright looked at her watch and discovered that, if she were going to reach St. Launce's early enough, to change her dress at the Falcon and get a chance of some early train to Plymouth. There were only two available. It was necessary to proceed at once. She was impatient. It seemed as if Pansy would never stop drinking, and the repose of the pool, the idle motions of the insects and flies upon it, the placid waving of the flags, the leaf skeletons, like Janice Filigree, placidly sleeping at the bottom, by their contrast with her own turmoil made her impatience greater. Pansy did turn at last, and went up the slope again to the high road. The pony came upon it, and stood crosswise, looking up and down. Elfright's heart throbbed erratically, and she thought, horses, if left to themselves, make for where they are best. Federal Pansy will go home. Pansy turned and walked on towards St. Launce's. Pansy at home, during summer, had little but grass to live on. After a run to St. Launce's she always had a feed of corn, to support her on the return journey. Therefore, being now more than halfway, she preferred St. Launce's. But Elfright did not remember this now. All she cared to recognize was a dreamy fancy that today's rash action was not her own. She was disabled by her moods, and it seemed indispensable to adhere to the program. So strangely involved are motives that, more than by her promise to Stephen, more even than by her love, she was forced on by a sense of the necessity of keeping faith with herself, as promised in the union vow of 10 minutes ago. She hesitated no longer. Pansy went, like the steed of Adonis, as if she told the steps. Presently the quaint gables and jumbled roofs of St. Launce's were spread beneath her, and going down the hill she entered the courtyard of the Falcon. Mrs. Buckle, the landlady, came to the door to meet her. The Swankerts were well known here. The transition from equestrian to the ordinary guise of railway travelers had been more than once performed by father and daughter in this establishment. In less than a quarter of an hour Elfright emerged from the door in her walking dress, and went to the railway. As he had not told Mrs. Buckle anything as to her intentions, and was supposed to have gone out shopping. An hour and 40 minutes later, and she was in Stephen's arms at the Plymouth station. Not upon the platform in the secret retreat of a deserted waiting room. Stephen's face boded ill. He was pale and despondent. What is the matter? She asked. We cannot be married here today, my Elfie. I ought to have known it and stayed here. In my ignorance I did not. I have the license, but it can only be used in my parish in London. I only came down last night, as you know. What shall we do? She said blankly. There's only one thing we can do, darling. What's that? Go on to London by a train just starting, and be married there tomorrow. Passengers for the 11.5 up train take their seats. Said a guard's voice on the platform. Will you go, Elfright? I will. In 3 minutes the train had moved off, bearing away with it Stephen and Elfright. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.